Welcome to the Regulatory Transparency Project's Fourth Branch podcast series. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Hello, and welcome to the Federal Society's Regulatory Transparency Project's Fourth Branch podcast. My name is Libby Dickinson, and I'm an assistant director with the Federal Society's practice groups. As a reminder, all opinions expressed are those of the speakers and not of the Federalist Society. Today, we are joined by a great group of tech and legal experts to discuss recent developments in the age verification debate, especially involving AI. Our speakers today include Professor Kevin Frazier, AI Innovation and Law Fellow at the University of Texas School of Law and Adjunct Research Fellow at the Cato Institute, Claire Morrell, Fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, Jennifer Huddleston, Senior Fellow in Technology Policy at the Cato Institute, and last but certainly not least, Graham Dufault, General Counsel at ACT, the App Association. Thank you all so much for joining us today. Kevin, I will hand things over to you to start things off.
Well, thank you for the opportunity, Libby. It's always a hoot to join RTP and dive into the thick of whatever technology issue is dominating the headlines and the top of the legislative agenda. And that's certainly the case when it comes to age verification. It seems like you can't go on any website, any social media feed, or learn about any new app without first asking, what information am I going to have to share to verify my age? And so, Claire, I want to start with you because when it comes to the myriad ways in which someone could attempt to verify that they are indeed not a minor or indeed of the appropriate age for whatever web service you're trying to access, you have an extensive knowledge of both what's feasible now or what's being proposed now, as well as some of the ideas that may be on the horizon from a technical standpoint. So, when I go to a bar, and yes, that does happen from time to time here in Austin, I show my ID, the bouncer lets me in, it's a grand old time. Come to Austin and visit, and you can have the first beer on me. It gets a heck of a lot more complicated online. So can you walk us through, when we hear about these new age verification schemes, especially in the AI context, what are the proposals out there right now to get a sense of whether you're the sort of user who belongs on that site?
Yes. So, and this is a constantly emerging field. And I think part of that too is we see some of these policy solutions being enacted and they're actually spurring more innovation in the kind of age verification industry. So I just really like to start by saying, like, the technology is there. Like, it is possible to verify a user's age in a way that is still protective of adult privacy and that is also can maximize kind of user choice. So what I think we're most often seeing is platforms offering a variety of options so that government ID or uploading your ID is not like the only method that you can use. And it's not usually people's preferred method. So I'm a big fan of recent kind of innovations like one by the Open Age Initiative called Age Key, which allows you to verify your age once on your device kind of locally. So maybe it's taking a picture of your driver's license with your phone. That information is not kind of being transmitted elsewhere. But what it does is it stores on your phone this age key, kind of like a pass key, that just gives a signal of, you know, yes, this person is above 18 or not. And so then right now, this is kind of a voluntary effort, but for participating then websites or platforms, if you're trying to access something age restricted, you can just say, I have an age key. And it's basically a double blind method because the website and platform doesn't learn anything about you other than just receiving your age key signal, like, yes, you're an adult or no, you're not. And then, you know, there's no kind of storage of information or transmission, and you, the user, are completely in control of that information the whole time. So it's your age key. And even for families that might have a shared device where there's parents on it, but there's also children, you can actually have multiple age keys because the way that you unlock and use your age key is with whatever kind of your passcode is to your phone or device or your, you know, biometric. If it's like you use your fingerprint to unlock your phone, you have to do that. There has to be some, like, I am the person attached to this age key. And then that information is transmitted. So that's just one example of what I would call these kind of double blind methods where these websites aren't getting any more information from you than you would want, other than the age signal that is needed. And, you know, so this age key initiative is great. I've seen this also done at the state level. So Louisiana kind of came up with their own solution using this platform they call Louisiana Wallet, which is basically like a digital driver's license. But same thing, if you wanted to access a pornography website in Louisiana and you're an adult, you can just say, I have Louisiana Wallet. And again, it's like a 40-second process where you just then go into your app and you say you're the person trying to access this website, gives you a little code that you just enter in, and then it transmits the information, just yes, this person's over 18. So I am personally a fan of those types of methods that I think we increasingly see being developed that, again, really only transmit the information that is needed, whether or not this person is an adult, without storing or receiving any other kind of sensitive personal information that an adult would not want to be transmitted to these websites or platforms. So I really like these kind of two-factor methods where there's some type of third party in between and where there is this kind of privacy protection of just this transmission of a signal saying the person is above or below a certain age. So we could certainly go into more detail. There's lots more kind of developments, but I would just, those are the kind of techniques and methods available that I focus on the most, because I think they allow us to accomplish both, which is protecting children from portions of the internet that we would deem to be unsafe or harmful to them, while at the same time maximizing user choice and adult privacy.
So thanks for kicking us off, Claire, because you gave us a lot to chew on, which is to say, you know, on one end of the spectrum, we can totally see a possibility of a world in which there's a double-blind system set up such that the user doesn't share more than they want to, and the end recipient, whether it's an app or a website, only learns the bare minimum. Yes, you should access. No, you shouldn't. This sounds like a technologically positive outcome that a lot of folks get behind. As is, we're seeing a lot of other tactics being used for age verification. For example, we know that OpenAI is planning on rolling out what I think is best described as an inferential approach of learning from user behavior. For example, what age you may be? Are you constantly querying ChatGPT for the best Pokemon to pick up and the coolest things to talk about in fourth grade? Well, that may be a good indication that you are indeed not an adult. Of course, there are other mechanisms. For example, Discord recently announced that they're either going to allow you to upload a photo of a government ID or take a selfie. And so there's a whole spectrum between this bouncer idea that we talked about initially, your sort of zero proof knowledge that we talked about, Claire, and then a very murky middle. And Jennifer, I want to come to you to talk about the policy and legal ramifications of, in particular, that murky middle. Why are we even having this debate over who should access what? And what does the fact of not having necessarily broadly distributed ideal technology and perfectly privacy protecting technology, how does that influence the legal and policy conversation?
Thanks, Kevin. And, you know, I actually want to go back to kind of the analogy you made that I think is an analogy that a lot of people kind of get hung up on in this debate of how is this any different than going to the store to buy beer or buy cigarettes or buy something in person when we're talking about the internet? And one of the ways that it is different is that the internet is an inherently expressive activity, that we're really talking about access to speech and information when we're talking about these kind of conversations. And that inherently these are going to impact not only the speech rights of young people, but also the speech rights of adults in ways that are very different from just flashing your ID to the cashier. Additionally, we're oftentimes talking about the retention policies of this information that can raise significant privacy and security risk, as well as significant questions around how that could impact long-standing traditions like anonymous speech. There's also a real question of what this means for more general purpose platforms. While we've seen discussions of this in very specific contexts, like obscenity, there are many more platforms that when we're looking at these broader laws could be impacted as well. So while we'll talk a lot about general purpose social media platforms like Discord or things like that, I know that Graham and Claire and I were all recently part of an FTC workshop on this question of what age verification might look like or what's going on in the debate about age verification. And one of the things that came up on the panel that Claire and I were both on is we also have to have important conversations about what does this mean for websites that aren't harmful but might end up with a minor on them that weren't in any way targeting minors. So the example that was used in our panel was a family wants to teach a middle school or teenage child about budgeting. They put them on a grocery store website and say, plan the grocery list and meal plan for the week and come up with our family budget. Most grocery stores are not going to anticipate that they're going to have under 18s or under 16s or under 13s regularly using their app or their website. But are they then going to be expected to age verify because someone could? And what does that mean for what might be different methods of teaching, different methods of understanding, different ways of having communications or information accessible for individuals that are not anticipated? Similarly, we can see that there might be very particular cases where, to your example of just even trying to train or make these inferences isn't always as clear cut as it may seem based on particular interests or certain information. And then there's also that real question of what does this mean for anonymous speech and what does this mean for data privacy and security? Both for the young people this is designed to protect in the sense that you are potentially creating a large database of information like photo IDs, like birth dates, like addresses in some cases, or who the parents are in some cases, that could be very lucrative to hackers. Or you're dealing with biometrics that, again, might require storing certain information or could be more sensitive and uncomfortable for people and aren't always accurate. We know that various of these tools are less accurate on certain communities, whether it's individuals of a certain race or whether it's based on gender or certain other physical characteristics. These aren't always able to guess accurately who is what age, and they're also not able to guess down to a granular level. So if someone's allowed to access a platform on their 18th birthday, a biometric scan may be able to guess that they're within a year of that, but it's not going to know when it was midnight on their 18th birthday. So you're still going to have many of those issues. Not to mention, what do you do, and I'm guessing Graham may talk about this, about platforms who now have to be responsible for this data that they may never have intended to have collected. They didn't necessarily want this level of information to have to secure, that now they're having to take additional security steps on the process. And then finally, I'll just close with the reality of these risks isn't just hypothetical. You brought up Discord and what they're doing. And it's been really interesting to see this debate emerge more globally because Discord was requiring this in the UK recently in compliance with their Online Safety Act. And already Discord had a leak of over 70,000 IDs that were included that were collected as part of the Online Safety Act. And so rolling this out globally, one can certainly understand why individual users are adults or children and whether they have any concerns about being in dark corners of the internet, that they still don't necessarily want that information available for them in something that could be seen as a security risk.
Yeah. And Jennifer, thanks for providing that overview, because whenever we're talking about age verification and online activity, we have to bring up that question of free expression. We have to bring up that question of a right to receive information. And critically, in a lot of these contexts, the chilling effect of if you are an adult and you were thinking of accessing certain information, not knowing for certain where that data is going to go, for how long, and for with whom it may be shared. Those are all very serious questions that may cause you to think twice before you go to a certain site. But Graham, we're fortunate to have you here because I think that a lot of these conversations around age verification often miss out on that compliance side of actually walking through what does it look like for companies who are suddenly subject to a digital ID requirement in Louisiana, but they've also got to figure out how to allow for some degree of age verification as imposed by New York and so on and so forth. What does this mean on the ground for some of your members, or what are you hearing when it comes to complying with differing age verification schemes?
Yeah, it's a great question. So you know, most of the membership is companies that are developing websites or apps or software for hire, you know, business to business services that are not necessarily, as Jennifer was sort of describing, focused on kids or trying to provide content that is going to present like sort of age-related risks that are foreseeable. And so for those of our member companies that are providing services like that, whether it's, you know, a creative writing app that is directed for K through 12 kids, or we have a member company, for example, that wants to relaunch a platform for peer-to-peer wagering. Pretty clearly going to be content that is only going to be made available for people that are 18 and up. And so, you know, for those kinds of companies and those kinds of services, there's, you know, an existing familiarity with age assurance processes, right? And so just to disaggregate the different types of age assurance. So you've got age verification, which is the highest level, most accurate. It's where you have to use direct evidence of a person's, you know, how long a person's been alive, plus an image that just, you know, ties the individual to the credential. And so there you're talking about like an ID, and as Claire was describing, it's an ID, right? It's got date of birth, it's got image, and it can be tied to the individual. And then down from there is age estimation and then age inference. And so the way the standard is developed internationally, it's the ISO IEC standard 27566-1. Sorry for the long number, but it's the standard that generally is used to determine what kind of age assurance service you're going to want to use to provide some level of assurance that you know that how old the person is that's coming to your website or your online service. And the reason differing levels exist is because they present differing levels of risk. As Jen just described, like at the highest end, you've got verification, which requires the credential to be collected. That's the most sensitive information on the spectrum, and you don't want it to get breached. You don't want it to get accessed in an unauthorized way. Unfortunately, if you do have a requirement like that, you create that possibility. And the possibility is greater if it is tied to a mandate, right? Because, the existence of a technology like what Clara was describing, where it's on device and then you just send a flag with just the right amount of information, is great and extremely useful. But if you require that it be deployed for every single situation, right, now you create the opportunity to build a profile using the flags, or on the other hand, you create a scenario where the company that's using the technology or supposed to be deploying the technology has to show their compliance. And if it's only on device and only available to the individual, you can't show compliance unless there is, you know, record keeping somewhere else. And so what we see is, If there is an interest, and there is an interest in quote unquote scaling up age verification, we ought to be thoughtful about the risks that it presents, in addition to making sure that the way it's deployed is sensitive to the risks that verification is trying to address. So, it's probably not appropriate to require verification for every single online experience. It's just, that's not how you address risk in general. And it's probably not how you ought to address risk when it comes to kid safety either.
And this tees up an important point about the AI specific use cases. And thanks for teeing this up, Graham, because when we're talking about the actual risks to individual expression, to the risks of data disclosures and data breaches that are unintended, Claire, I wonder if you could help emphasize why this age verification debate seems to be particularly heightened in the AI context, where we saw in FSC versus Paxton very quickly that there was a sort of intermediate scrutiny applied to the idea of having age verification for minors when accessing obscene content. And depending on who you ask, that was either an incredibly narrow opinion, or it was something that is going to lend itself to future expansion over time. We will let the next RTP set of guests dive into the full range of FSC versus Paxton interpretations.
Or you can listen to the two podcasts Claire and I are already on that topic. There we go.
Give it a listen. A blast from the past. I love it. But for now, can we map this onto AI companions in particular? Why are we seeing seemingly nearly every state legislature have some bill related to age verification and AI companions?
Yes, this is a great question. And I'm actually glad you asked this, because I was thinking to myself, I'm like, I feel like we almost need to step back a little bit too and ask ourselves, like, why are we even having this conversation, right? Because I realize, you know, that Graham and Jennifer are both highlighting potential risks or concerns. I think a lot of those can be addressed. Like, personally, I have solutions in mind, but I think the bigger question is just, like, what is the purpose behind a lot of these laws? Like, what are they trying to accomplish? And I think, you know, at the core, especially when it comes to these AI companions, is protecting kids. And I think just recognizing that, yes, like, we have liberties, but that there is also this recognition that our liberties have limits, that there are some compelling government interests by which adults accept certain limits on our liberties in order to protect children or fulfill other kind of compelling government interests. So obviously that it's already been clearly established kind of in legal precedent. There's a compelling government interest for states to protect children from obscenity. But now we have this new technology, AI, and particularly, at least the bills that I've been tracking, are really focused not just on general kind of AI chatbots, but these AI companions that are designed to really mimic a human and a human-like relationship. And we're seeing, just even in these kind of early days of this technology, just a lot of harms to children who have developing brains that are not as discerning, that they actually believe that this AI companion is a real person and that they can fall then into really dangerous kind of romantic relationships. Kids have taken their lives because these AI companions told them to, or led them to believe that if they kind of killed themselves, they would then be able to actually meet and join this AI companion. So I think states are recognizing, whoa, wait a second. Like, this is a very new and kind of harmful technology that already is showing clear evidence of a harm to minors. And so it's not saying that adults can't use these things, but at least to protect this next generation, especially until there's more, honestly, guidelines around how these technologies are being developed. I think states are kind of quickly jumping in to say, wait, hold on a second. We don't want kids to be accessing this particular feature of AI. And I think that's really an important part of this too, like, from my standpoint, is, you know, states are going to run into danger or kind of problems if they're making these laws content-based. You know, they're going to trigger strict scrutiny. But if they're making it about the design features of this AI, that there's this particular kind of medium of this AI companion-like design, I think that those laws could then fall under intermediate scrutiny. And obviously, then there's legal things to be debated in the courts. But that is kind of my understanding of the kind of just reality that the states are facing, and that parents are really desperate for help. And that's kind of at the thrust of a lot of my work. You know, I think others will say, okay, just leave it up to the parents. But with a lot of these technologies, it is extremely difficult for parents to effectively oversee everything that their child could be doing or accessing online. And when there are new AI companion apps popping up in the app store every day that a parent wouldn't even know about, all the testimonies that I have heard from parents kind of harmed by these AI companions, they had no idea their child had downloaded this app from the app store, had, you know, built this relationship with this AI companion until it was too late. And Common Sense Media had a report that, like, 73% of teens are using AI companions and only 37% of parents are aware. And so to me, this is like a clear example where, okay, we're recognizing something's inherently harmful to children, the way that we have in other kind of precedents in our laws, and we're trying to just age restrict it. So that's my understanding of kind of the desire the states have in proposing these laws, and just kind of that general kind of zooming back framework of, like, why are we even talking about age verification? I think at the heart of it is this purpose of wanting to protect children from specific design-based portions of the internet that are just really harmful to them and their developing minds. So that's my 2 cents.
worth a nickel even with inflation. And I will say that, you know, it's also worth pointing out, I'll use my moderator's prerogative here, to solicit any and all empirical evidence from listeners on the actual rate of usership among some teens and some younger users, because depending on who you ask, OpenAI did a survey, only 1.9 of users are actively using ChatGPT for personal relationships. Of course, 1.9 of 800 million people is a heck of a lot of people, but paying in particular attention to what these dynamics actually look like, I think, is just good for evidence-driven policy. But I'll get off my hobby horse, turn it back to our excellent guests. So, Jennifer, we just heard a kind of balancing or one interpretation of how we may balance the need for personal liberty, personal protection of fundamental rights versus the very real reality of looking out for the general welfare and in particular our kids, which always receive a heightened degree of deference in terms of their interests. And so how are you weighing this conversation of where to strike a happy medium in this very difficult and oftentimes tragic or at least politically fraught conversation?
I want to start by saying that we have to distinguish between what might be best practices, what we as consumers might want to expect from companies, and what needs to actually be a legislative mandate. And I think that's really particularly clear in these kind of situations. I want to also acknowledge, I know there have been people who have had extremely negative experiences with any kind of technology, whether it's social media or AI chatbots or any other technology out there. And I am not trying to say that those experiences, when they are often very real, you know, did not occur or anything along those lines. I'm also a former teacher, and so I understand how difficult it is on parents and teachers when they encounter what are oftentimes technologies that young people may know more about than grownups do, and trying to learn that in real time. So those are all kind of my disclaimers before I get into why I'm very concerned about the push to legislate, whether it is age verification or age bans on certain types of technology. The first of which is it is very difficult to define these technologies in law. Kevin, I know you're an AI expert, and one of the issues with defining AI in any kind of legislation is what even is AI from a legal definition? Because otherwise you accidentally end up in a world where, oops, the government just banned spell check or autocorrect or talk to text or any number of technologies that we've started forgetting are AI. But even when it comes to this question around AI companions, where is the line between a general purpose AI and an AI companion in such a way that can be defined in legislation is going to be very difficult. So someone who creates a personalized tutor using ChatGPT or using other services that are available to really help them understand material by having that tutor maybe even impersonate a celebrity or their favorite character or something like that might not be possible under these laws. That's certainly a beneficial use. It's something that can get young people really engaged in these kind of in their learning, things like that. One can certainly see why that would be a pro. In other cases, while there certainly are young people who have had negative experiences with chatbots, there are also young people for whom this has been very valuable in helping them develop different ideas or helping them explore interpersonal skills when perhaps they feel isolated or are struggling with something in ways that they're not quite ready to talk to their parents or talk to someone at school about. It can be a way of helping young people as well as having those negative interactions. When it comes to the legal standards, I think it's important to recognize kind of the distinction in something like the FSCV Paxton case. As we alluded to earlier, Claire and I have had multiple podcasts on this particular case, and I'm not going to try and argue about which of our, you know, we know where the two different interpretations of that lie. But in FSCV Paxton, it is tied to this understanding around the government's role in protecting young people from obscene sexual content. The other case that's going to be really relevant in these discussions is Brown v. Entertainment Merchants Association, which where there is an attempt to regulate violent video games that was found that the state did not have a sufficiently compelling interest to engage in this regulation, this kind of age gating of certain video games in ways that would potentially prevent impact adult speech rights as well. Real questions is going to be in some of these cases, where do these technologies fall? I personally think that where we are right now, we're more in that world of the Brown v. Entertainment Merchants Association, where we haven't seen a clear evidence of a specific harm that the state has a responsibility to protect minors from, in the same way that we did in the kind of obscene sexual material that was at issue in Paxton. So I do think that there would be significant First Amendment challenges in these type of bans, in addition to the concerns around how this could impact adult speech rights as well, because as I often like to point out, the only way to ensure someone's not under 16, 18, et cetera, when you're looking at something that is a true verification requirement, is to also verify that everyone is over 18, 16, or whatever age it's set. So when we're exploring these, we can't only think about what does this mean for young people's access to this tool? What does it mean for the potential beneficial applications that there are as well? But also, what does it mean for adults' access? And on that, I do think that there are less restrictive means. And I do think there are some best practices and cultural norms that hopefully we would see evolve, some of which I think Claire and I would probably agree upon in terms of having more user controls, having more information out there for parents, making sure that parents know how to have conversations with their young people around these technologies, around understanding the difference in reality and fiction, the same way that we do with other technologies or other forms of media and entertainment, so that each individual family is able to come up with the solution that works best for them. In some families, that may mean you're not allowed to use this tool until you're a certain age. In other families, it may mean you're allowed to use it with supervision, or with me as a with a parent or a teacher enacting certain controls that might be available. And in other cases, it may be families feel that their young person is responsible and able to use it in a creative and beneficial way, where they only feel that minimal supervision is necessary. So ensuring that families have that choice as well.
So this is an excellent overview of the sort of values that we have to pay attention to and the alternative means we may consider to make sure that everyone's use of technology aligns with their values, their family's values, and the limits of what's technologically feasible at any given point in time. But Graham, I want to know, from a sort of developer side, for the folks who are building the tools of the future, what are you hearing right now? Because we know that Australia just enacted a age ban for social media tools. We know we've got the EU constantly thinking about a smorgasbord of ways to regulate just about anything, but we'll save that for another podcast as well. What are you hearing right now from the kind of folks on the ground trying to build the AI tools of the future? And what parts of this age verification conversation do you think need to more regularly consult these labs and these developers?
Well, it's great because we've been pretty active in a lot of the debates around the world in the UK and Australia and elsewhere, as they have considered, you know, age appropriate design codes in the state legislatures as they have been developing those kinds of frameworks. And so the great news is that we feel like our voice is being heard in some of these venues. What I will say is that the unsung hero of managing age-related risks is really going to be standards development, and like it is in so many of these kind of emerging technology areas, and where our member companies are sort of crying out for more to be done more quickly, because you have the AI, like the AI NIST, NIST's AI risk management framework, which is very high level, and then sort of different pieces of it are being devolved to different areas. And so addressing age-related risks is one of those areas where you want to see a lot of activity take place. And I think that's where some of the the introduction of all of these bills at the state level has probably helped put pressure on some of that. And I do think, though, that we do have to be really thoughtful in, again, taking a step back and asking that question, what is the role of government in making sure that the expectations of consumers are met, that the kinds of safety features that are appropriate for XYZ context in which a user might find themselves with a given service are in place. A lot of that has to happen at sort of the design level. And for our member companies, when they're designing systems like this at the app layer, they're doing it in a very risk conscious way, right? And they're constantly asking themselves, all right, what if this system answers Y? What if it answers X? And so that's, you know, it's very much top of mind, and we just don't want to, have those risks sort of dictate that a high bright line set of rules for an oddly shaped set of category of AI systems that may not make sense in 2 years from now or something like that. So government is a pretty blunt instrument, and we have to be really careful about how it fits in with all the different ways that, you know, my member companies and others in the ecosystem are working on trying to keep kids safe.
And I love that point on the fact that the AI ecosystem is in fact more diverse than just OpenAI, Anthropic, and Google. There are other models out there for folks who are not talking about AI constantly, like perhaps myself. My wife likes to joke that my job is to just talk about AI, and I'm not convinced she's wrong at this point, but we'll leave my marital debates for yet another podcast episode. Claire, we've got a lot of listeners who want to know what to pay attention to going forward. So I want to kick off our rapid questionnaire to conclude this great episode of RTP with your own concluding thoughts on what you think should really be top of mind for folks as we continue to have this age verification in the age of AI conversation.
Yeah, I would just say, like, I think states are going to be active in this area. And I think, you know, Congress is too. And I know Jennifer was talking about, you know, can be difficult to define these things in legislation. Just because it's difficult, I think, isn't a reason to not try. I think that legislators are actually really trying to grapple with these things well. And so, you know, I would just point to Senator Hawley introduced a bipartisan act called the GUARD Act, which would try to age restrict AI companions on a federal level. I actually think that the definition in that bill is very strong. EPPC, we actually put out a model bill for states with language that we felt like was really narrow and targeted to AI companions. And I would also just say to a lot of the concerns that Graham and Jennifer raised, I think like leaving things sometimes up to the companies themselves isn't the best solution. Like you were talking about this risk of creating these, you know, data retention centers or having these companies then collecting all this information we wouldn't want them to have. I think a lot of those things can actually be standardized well in law. I've seen good laws like Australia's banning social media for minors and other state laws that have really strong data protections written into the law that says you cannot retain this information. It must be deleted immediately, or requiring some type of third-party verifier. So it's not the company themselves collecting this information. So I think we have solutions that the law can actually write to make these both privacy protecting, but also effective. And so things I'm tracking is like kind of all these bills at the state level. I think we should keep paying attention to what happens there. Also, Congress, I think, is grappling with what to do with AI and AI companions. And then I will just end by saying, you know, I really do think that some laws are necessary to put some guardrails on this technology, and particularly for kids. Like the question I have is, are we just trying to run this massive social experiment on our kids, kind of the way that social media was run? And now that has obviously borne out to be very harmful and addictive to children. Kind of, are we going to repeat our same mistakes and just let children access these AI companions, you know, to their detriment? Because I think that's kind of the question mark in my mind is, what are we doing to this next generation? We don't really know very much about this technology. And that kind of urges me in the direction of caution. I think if over time it proves that these companions are amazing and they do wonderful things for human flourishing, I mean, we can always go back then and revisit that in the law and say, you know what, it's not as harmful as we thought. But I think just prudence and kind of caution of, are we just going to subject this next generation to this massive social experiment of AI companions? And the last thing I'll just say is, as parents really do need the help of the government, because there's absolutely no parental consent involved or required whatsoever for a child to get an AI account, develop a relationship with an AI companion. Like, a parent would truly be none the wiser. So kind of the idea that, oh, you know, parents can oversee this, it's like they really are not in a position, like, legally where they're able to. There's no requirements for parental consent or controls. And so I do think that that is what kind of tips me over the edge and saying, I really do actually want the government to kind of step in and act. But I do think it matters how that's done. So not all laws are created equal. And so we really do need to be careful, which is part of the reason that we at EPBC put out a model bill that we felt would be constitutionally strong and privacy protecting of adults, while also trying to help states who want to protect their kids accomplish that goal as well. So I think we have to think wisely about these laws. But that is kind of where I am at, is I want to protect this next generation from this technology that I think is already showing to be harmful, but that we just really don't know enough. And it worries me that we're just going to let it run amok among all of this next rising generation and then regret that later.
Well, if the last answer was worth a nickel, I think that's at least a quarter worth of thought. And I guess that just about everyone can agree, especially on the AI literacy question, that helping parents have what I like to refer to as the quote unquote new talk. We've got birds and bees. Now we have to talk about bits and bots. I think everyone would love to see that happen.
Wow, but Jennifer, that's great.
What else do you want to leave listeners with? What should be top of mind for them?
Yeah, I mean, I think, well, Claire and I have another podcast, I guess, just unpacking the last statement. But on this particular issue, I think there are a couple things. First, to what you said, Kevin, and also what Claire said of parent, I would agree, parents need help. And we have to consider the role of education, not regulation. And education comes from multiple sources. Education comes from various civil society and third-party groups, groups like Common Sense that was mentioned earlier, groups like Family Online Safety Initiative that can help parents know what does it mean to have the bits and bots conversation with your child or teen as this is evolving. It also at times comes from government and government's role as providing individuals with information so that they can make the decisions that are right from them, that these products are out there so that they understand what it means to live in an AI age. And I think that can certainly be part of the conversation as well. I think one of the things that makes this difficult is that we don't have a clear definition of what the harm that policy would even be trying to address is. And that makes it very difficult to look at this in a policy format as opposed to an individual and societal norms kind of format. If we say that we want to prevent potential harm to the next generation, there are a lot of different things that that can mean. In some cases, it means a very physical, very specific access to certain harmful content. In other cases, it can mean things that could actually shut down really important discourse, discussions that are oftentimes really important for both adults and for young people to be able to have technological tools to work through. And it could also potentially harm young people to shut down technology, because it would also prevent those beneficial applications, not only in the sense that our young people are going to be entering the workforce in a technological and digitally enabled age. We want them to be competitive, not only in the workforce here in the U.S., but we want our U.S. workforce to be competitive globally. And that means that they will likely need to know how to use these tools in their particular work. And that means they're going to have to get experience with them while they're in K-12 education and in higher education, so that they understand what it means to use these tools in meaningful and productive ways. And so that hopefully parents can provide guidance while they're in that phase as well of using them in beneficial ways. If we shut down a tool entirely, not only do we eliminate any potential harms, we also eliminate any potential benefits. And those benefits can be things that we could never have predicted if the three of us on this podcast tried to list what the potential benefits are. There are things that we would never think of that some kid in a garage right now will think of that will change all of our lives 5 years from now. And so the way I see this is that we want to make sure that we are allowing that full array of benefits that we can't even predict to go on. And that if we do see those situations where we need to respond to a harm, that we're doing so in as narrowly tailored a way as possible and with a full awareness of privacy and speech rights for both young people and adults in mind.
Well, I have to say the return on pod has been very high here. I think listeners are getting a lot for their 44 minutes worth. Graham, bring us home. What else do listeners need to pay attention to? Because we have a lot of ideas that are surely filling up their heads right now.
I just don't want us to end up sort of underestimating or brushing aside the risks of legislating in ways that actually make it harder for parents to have control over their kids' online experience or for kids to have a safe experience. And like there's a concrete example I'm thinking of. There's this bill that's been going around the states, and even there are some members of the Energy and Commerce Committee that are thinking about doing it. It's called the App Store Accountability Act. That it's a set of requirements on app stores to do age verification and then send signals to every single developer on the stores. And along with it is this requirement for the stores to collect parental consent to download and then to send a flag to every single developer. So a developer would have to push an update to their app to receive that flag and manage it. And I call that out because it is a mandate to do a worse version of what already exists. Because right now, so I've got my son's 8 years old. He's got his little device, and anytime he wants to download something, I get a text message and I get to accept or reject it. I always reject it. Reject. And then it does facial recognition to make sure it's me, and the rejection goes through. It all happens at the operating system level. So the developer doesn't have to receive a flag for that. There doesn't have to be this additional failure point and a mandate for like the developer to take additional steps, which many of these companies that have apps like a barbershop or a local restaurant chain on the stores, they're not going to be super fast about pushing that update, unfortunately, because it's been a while since they've engaged a developer to create the app. And then, you know, they're going to have to hire them again to make these updates. So I'd rather have an operating system, an app store that is like responsive to my needs directly, rather than just complying with a blanket mandate, by the way, which has a set of requirements that take us back a few steps instead of having something that's seamless and works really well. So this is not theoretical. This is happening in real time, and it's a real problem. And we have to be careful about how we try and deploy government and tell them to go to try and fix these problems.
Well, certainly we left with more questions than answers, but they're very important questions, and I'm glad we raised them. Claire, Jennifer, and Graham, thank you so much for joining. And Libby, as always, thank you for the opportunity.
Absolutely. Thank you all so much for coming on and for sharing your insights. This is certainly a very, you know, fast-changing issue, so I'm positive that this is not the last that we will hear on this. That's for sure. Thank you to our audience for tuning in today. And if you're interested in learning more about all of our programming here at the Federalist Society, you can check out our website at fedsoc.org. That is fedsoc.org. Thank you so much.
On behalf of the Federalist Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, thanks for tuning in to the Fourth Branch Podcast. Catch every new episode when it's released, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spreaker. For the latest from RTP, please visit our website at regproject.org. That's regproject.org.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.